This is Rock and Roll Grad School with your hosts, Heidi Hedquist and Luke Poling. All their favorite songs are slow and sad.
Hello, kiddies. We are going to have a good time together because today, we should first note that we are releasing this early. You didn't sleep through 2 days. It is Monday.
It's Christmas in July.
It is Christmas in July. It is Graham Russell Day, which should be a holiday, shouldn't it?
Oh my gosh, it totally should be a holiday.
That'd be great. So we were so thrilled with talking with Graham and getting to hang out with Graham. And just any time spent with Graham was lovely. And we thought we would share this to both the Y feed for folks who perhaps have forgotten that we have another show.
Or never learned.
Is that the greater sin, having never learned?
Maybe.
Yeah. And for the regular grad school folks, hey, you get this a couple of days early.
Because it's that good.
It is that good. So we talked to Graham Russell. And if perhaps you're saying, who is Graham Russell? Well, sit yourself down.
Let us enlighten you.
Yes. You will know Graham better as the taller member in Air Supply. And I mean, no disrespect to Russell, his singing partner. And they are out on the road right now.
Yes.
Bringing love wherever they go.
Making love out of nothing at all.
Exactly. Which Graham didn't write, but that doesn't matter.
It's still their song.
It's still their song.
And rest in peace, Jim Steinman.
Exactly. And I feel like I wonder how often both Graham and Russell have someone coming up to them admitting that conception happened on side one of one of their records.
Yeah, especially the greatest hits.
Right.
I mean, all of the records are fantastic, but the greatest hits is one of those greatest hits that was gangbusters. Everybody had it.
Right. I feel like they've got to do a lot of kind of smiling and nodding and going, okay.
I feel like Lost in Love is probably a good thing song.
Yeah.
That swelling and all that.
Yeah. The one that you love. I mean, there's a lot where it's sort of like there's things could be happening.
Yeah.
While this is going on.
But One That You Love, I feel not as much.
Hmm.
That's more like pleading. That's more like.
Well, Even the Nights Are Better.
Well, that one for sure.
Right.
That's a good one.
There's so many. There's so many.
You guys are heading out of the road again pretty soon, right?
We are, yeah. We've done a few shows already. We've done about 7 or 8 shows already. But they were, you know, scattered out. They weren't consecutive. But and we have one in about 10 days. And we're off until the end of July. So it's still very, very scattered, you know.
You looking forward to it? Do you kind of miss it when you don't have that routine?
I do. I am looking forward to it because I have to play live. Although I've really enjoyed the time that I've had over the last 15 months. But I am looking forward to getting back. I'm looking forward to getting back in, inside the machine, we call it. You know, once we're on the road, it kind of keeps ticking over and we all get into this rhythm, this pattern, which is really essential to get into for a band like us, you know. But we do so many shows in normal times that you have to get into that mindset, and I'm looking forward to getting into that. Instead of playing a couple of shows, then having another 2 weeks off, which is rather unusual for us.
Do you guys still have to rehearse after the song?
No, we don't rehearse. We have sound checks, but we don't rehearse. Even with the new songs, which I've been bringing constantly, we rehearse those at sound checks, you know. But we did rehearse when we first came back. We did three shows in January, and we did a live stream and rehearsed for a week for that show because it was very important. And we hadn't played together for almost a year, so we needed to rehearse for that, which we did. And it was cool. You know, it was nice to... It's amazing how much you forget and how much, you know, when you're in that rhythm, how much is automatic. And, you know, I've personally lost that automation, but I got it by the fifth or sixth day of rehearsal. But it's funny how you get into that, groove, you know, and it just happens. It's bizarre.
Yeah. And so you said you were working on a lot of stuff over the kind of hiatus.
Yeah, I did. I wrote about 30 songs. Well, I write musicals too, you know, apart from the band. And I also have another little band that I work with. And it's just a trio. And so between the three things, the three projects, I keep myself pretty busy. I really need to do that because I write all the time. And so I have these songs coming every day. And so I need to place them and find places that I can put them, you know.
Is that something that has always been the case? Have you always just been overflowing with songs and things that are you just kind of always been constantly writing? Or is that something that, as you said, has sort of got the well-oiled machine going that started to happen more?
Well, no, it's always been there. Ever, you know, I began writing songs when I was 12 years old.
Right.
And I didn't know what they were or anything. I didn't know anything about music or songs. And I just started to write these songs. And, you know, I played guitar, but barely. I knew about four chords at that time. I was fascinated with the guitar. And I just started to write songs. I think... I was very heavily influenced by the Beatles at that time because they were just coming along in like 62, 63, and I was just enamored by them, you know, but more about the songs, and I never knew why. And so I've been constantly writing songs ever since that time. And so now I'm kind of used to it, you know. If a day goes by now and I don't write a part of a song or start a new song, I get really concerned. I think, oh, okay, here it is. I'm done for now. It's over. You know, this big 60-year songwriting thing is finally ended. But it's just something I love to do more than anything. I just love it, you know.
When in the process do you kind of think, this is for the trio, this is for a show, or this is for me and Russell?
Yeah, I usually know by the tone of the song. You see, what for me, and I know every songwriter is different, I never know what the song's going to be like. I just never know what vibe it is, what rhythm, anything about it. It just comes. And I go, oh, that's weird. And suddenly there'll be a weird time change, like a 7/4 time change. And I don't know where it comes from. And I go, oh, that's interesting. And I'll put it, and it goes into the song. And I never know what, until the song's finished, who it's for. But as soon as I begin it, I get a pretty good idea. You know, if it's a big epic ballad, then I think, oh, this is a song for Russell. If it's something that's a bit unusual, it's for my little trio. Of course, on the musicals, I'm given scenarios by the book writers to write a song for this scene, or to write a song for a specific place and time in the show. So they're boundaries that I have. So I'm really lucky because I have the musicals, which does have a lot of boundaries, and I enjoy writing to stories and to scenarios. But I also like being very abstract for my trio. And then, of course, for Ursify, which is my main my main focus, and it always has been, you know.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere that both you and Russell both saw the Beatles perform consistently, you in Australia. Is that true? And what was that show like? What do you remember of it?
I'm comedian David Race in Los Angeles. I host a celebrity-filled paranormal talk show like no other. Monstrosity has great guests answering weird questions. You won't believe the combo of celebrities and paranormal experts who've been on this show. I guarantee you'll like Monstrosity, or you get your time back. Go to monstrositypodcast.com right now and take a look.
Oh, I remember every moment. I saw them in England. I was living in Nottingham, and Russell saw them in Australia. We were both, he's 15 and I was 14. He's a year older than me. And I saw them at my local cinema, believe it or not. And they were on a package tour with a few other Merseysound groups that were following in the steps of the Beatles. But it changed my whole life when I saw them. I mean, I was just so freaked out because I was a huge Beatles fan. And when I saw them, it was like meeting God or something for me. And it changed my whole life. And everything about the songs I've been writing, in that sense, I went, oh, okay, now I get it. That's what I'm doing. You know, I'm writing all these songs. Most of my early songs are pretty terrible, and I think everybody's are in the beginning. But when I saw the Beatles, the penny dropped, and I went, oh, yeah, okay, that's it. And from that moment on, my whole life was different. Thankfully, I needed it at that point. And I just absorbed myself into music, you know, totally. At school, my schoolwork suffered. I was quite bright at school. I was in a very posh school. We had uniforms and everything. But a lot of that went out the window because I was just driven by music and writing songs in particular, you know.
When did you know that you could make it as a musician? That not only was this just your passion and your love, but that this was going to be your career?
Well, I think for any musician or artist, there are certain levels of achievement, you know. In the very early 70s, I picked my guitar in different little venues like folk clubs and pizza bars. And for me, that was the first time I thought, oh, I've made it. I can earn a living, which I was. I was playing in five pizza parlors, Monday to Friday, different ones. Then at the weekend, I'd play in a university venue, you know, for maybe 200 people. And then I played folk clubs. I mean, I wasn't making a lot of money, but I was earning a decent amount for them. I was making about $150 a week. So for me, at that point, I thought, oh, I've made it. You know, I'm there. But of course, then my aspirations started to broaden out. But the great thing about that time for me was I was playing my own songs, which was very unusual for any artist at that point. And even in the pizza parlors, you know, when I first got the job there, I actually got the job myself. And I was actually at a pizza parlor in Melbourne, and there was a dais in the corner of the room, and I was eating pizza, and I said to the manager there, who I didn't know, I said, what's that dais? It was like a 4-foot square stage. I said, what's that over there? He said, well, that's where a long time ago, we used to have a guitar player in there. You know, we used to come in and sing some songs and, you know, all kinds of different cover songs. And I said, well, why don't you have somebody now? I said, oh, I never really thought about it. I said, would you like to have someone there? And he said, yeah, that'd be interesting. He said, do you know anybody? And I said, yes, me. So I pushed myself in, and then, you know, I did really well. And so he offered me, they had like 10 or 11 restaurants in that chain. And so I played most of them, but I played every night, you know, and I wasn't making a lot of money. I'd get a $20 and a pizza, but that was enough for me. So for me, that was, I considered myself being successful. But then that all changed as time went on. You know, I got kind of a bit bored with that because there was a lot of kids in there, you know, chomping on pizza and making a lot of noise. And even though I was playing my own songs, nobody was listening. I was background music and nobody cared. In fact, I did an experiment more than one night. I thought to myself, nobody cares what I'm doing, although I'm getting paid for it, it's great. So I'm going to make a song up as I go. And nobody knew. I just created some chords made up silly words, and I just sang songs that I made up on the spot. However, it was a great exercise for me, and people still didn't even notice, you know. And so I thought, well, that's good. It's all good. It's great getting paid, and, you know, I'm working. But I need I need a little more quality. I need to be recognized for what I'm doing. And so I moved on, you know, and I started to play more universities with a more sophisticated crowd, if you like. But it wasn't until I met Russell, till I auditioned for Superstar, that everything changed once again. You know, in my life, there's been several times where there've been eureka moments, and the Beatles was one. Getting into Superstar was the second one, and that changed everything again. But of course, in a musical such as Superstar, which is just brilliant,
right,
you've really got to be good, you know. And I didn't think I was good enough to get in, first of all. But I managed to get in, and of course, I met Russell on the first day, and everything changed once again. And funnily enough, Russell, I've always thought, well, not thought, we've always believed that it was predestined that we meet and create something together. And there were so many coincidences in those first few days. And we went, wow, really? You saw the Beatles, I saw them too. You know, we're born in the same month, we have the same name, and it was kind of all that stuff. So we went, oh, wow, this is kind of interesting. Then when we sang together for the very first time, it just sounded really good. And even I was, oh, wow, this sounds really good. And we were just singing a Beatles song, you know, I can't remember which one. But it sounded great. And then I started to play my own songs backstage between shows. And Russell would come up to me and join in. And he'd say, oh, what's that song? I said, oh, it's this or that. And he just sang with me, and it just sounded fabulous, you know. And there was something going on at that moment in time. And so that was how it all started, you know.
Who were you playing in Superstar?
I was just an apostle.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, really, very good. Touché. I was an apostle, but rumor had it in the show that there was a previous production in Australia about 2 years before that, and rumor had it that they had the costume, this had the same costumes. And, you know, I'm very tall, and rumor had it that they had this costume that was really long. Instead of trimming it, they wanted to get a guy that was tall, so which was me, and so that's why I got the job. However, Russell originally was an apostle too, and we shared different things on stage. Like the apostles were split into two. You had a partner. So that you reacted with or went, oh, you know, when you saw Jesus. And we were like reactors together. And that was by complete chance. So that was another thing. And then when they allotted dressing room spaces for the apostles, mine was next to Russell. So we became instant friends. But we were both apostles. In fact, when Russell joined the show, he was a soldier first, and he was an apostle, but his main role was a soldier, and he was in his vinyl suit, and he couldn't even sing because it was a black vinyl, and it was really thick and really hot, and he couldn't sing because you wouldn't hear him, And then one afternoon, between shows, the director called us all up on stage. He was actually quite furious. He said, "You're not singing loud enough, and I need more of the boys." And I stepped forward and just said, "That's because you've got three of the best male voices in the show in as soldiers, you know." And I don't know why he put them in as soldiers. And I said, "You've got the best male voice, apart from the two leads, is a soldier, and you should get him out of there, you know." And I mean, he didn't take time to that, me kind of turning or giving him advice, but he needed to do it because Russell needed to be heard, and because his voice was just incredible. And in the end, Russell understood it. Judas, Annas, not quite, Peter, Simon, all of them. And he played Judas over 100 times, actually, during the show, you know.
The most incredible and difficult role ever written.
Oh, my God. It's so hard vocally, you know. I mean, you've got to be an incredible tenor to do it.
Right.
It's funny, one day, you know, Russell had the voice for it, but he didn't think he was agile enough to be Judas, because the guy that was Judas was a big star in Australia. He was just a superstar. His name was John English, and he was actually English, but he was incredible as Judas. In fact, Time magazine were doing a review of the Australian show, and they said that John English was probably the greatest Judas that there ever was in the superstar paradigm, you know. Which is a lot, because Ted Neely was incredible too. Not Ted Neely, the Carl, I can't remember his last name.
Yeah, it's, oh my gosh, it is Carl. It'll come to me.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so Russell had to go on as Judas, you know, between shows. We did two shows, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and he came up and Harry, the producer, said, you know, "You've got to go on. John's not feeling well." And so Russell did it. And afterwards, Harry, the producer, was notorious in Australia. He said, "You sound great, but you look like a gorilla." So he really kind of put the damper on for Russell. But he played Judas over 100 times. And he actually played Jesus once, too. And he played Simon and Peter. So once people heard him, he really took flight, as he should have, you know. And Russell was very well liked by everyone. He was like one of those popular guys. And it was great, you know. The great thing was that both John, who played Judas, and Trevor, who played Jesus, who were both very big stars, we became great friends with them, and I don't know why or how, but we just became great friends with them, and they were instrumental in us doing our thing. When we started to rehearse, they would ask us, "How's it going?" You know, and come along and listen to us, and they'd say, "Wow, you guys sound great." So we had a leg up, if you like, and that's another reason why we always thought it was predestined that the air supply happened, you know.
Hey, do you like queer comedians? Do you like learning more about what it takes to take your life story and turn it into a comedy act and then go up on stage and talk about it in front of hundreds of people? Well, that is what my podcast is all about. My name is Ben Hawes, and I am a queer millennial comedian living in New York City, and I'm on a journey of living my life in bold. So in my podcast, I interview other queer comedians about how they're living their lives more boldly and more authentically. The podcast is called Life in Bold with Ben Hawes. That's me, and you have to go check it out. It'll make you giggle, but we also do get deep. It's queer, it's funny, it's bold. Listen to Life in Bold wherever you get your shows.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just a little bit you shared, I totally agree. And thank God it was. I don't know what we'd do without it. So I would be lost. I would be completely lost.
Right. Well, you know, we've had a lot of luck in our career. I mean, more than most bands, most artists. I don't know for what reason, but, you know, we had a lot of luck when we met. Then we put a record out, you know, a single. We were signed to a record company. We went to every record company in Australia, and there were about a dozen in those days. And they all turned us down and said, no. And we did made a demo in the pit of the theater, the Superstar Theater. And we just used a couple of the guys out of the Superstar band, the keyboard player and the drummer and the bass player. And we recorded two little demos on a cassette player that was like about 6x6. Even the quality of it was just terrible, but it just sounded amazing. But everybody turned us down when we went, you know, we were really, thought we were, we had a couple of great songs and everybody turned us down. And the last one we went to, and we were kind of dejected, said, oh God, it's the last one, you know. And he said, you know, my gut instinct is saying, I don't want to do this. But he said, for some reason, I'm going to sign you and we're going to make a record. We're going to make a record like in 2 days. And we recorded the two songs that we get on the demo. And they put the songs out. But the night before the record was going to be pressed, we didn't even have a name. And he said, we need a name. So Russ and I agreed the next morning, whoever had the best name, we had to go with it, whatever it was. We had to have a name. And that night, I had a dream about this big billboard, and it was white, and it was huge. And around the perimeter of the billboard were all these multicolored flashing lights, like strobes going off, like there was something happening. And in the middle of the billboard, in big black letters, it said, Air Supply. And I told Russell the next morning, I said, I had this weird dream. And he said, oh, it sounds like a pretty decent name. Let's go with it. And that's why we went with it. And the producer, who became very good friends with two, who produced the two tracks, he said, that's a weird name. I'm not sure about that. And I said, yeah, I know it's weird, but that's all we've got. And he put the record out. And a week later, it burst into the charts. It just got played straight away. And about 3 weeks later, it went to number one. And so the producer said, we need to make an album. And our Superstar run was coming to an end. And we had about 2 weeks left to go. We finished Superstar, and we went and made an album in a week. And with all orchestrations, and it was mixed and ready to go. And the album came out, and it sounded incredible. And it went to number one, and suddenly we were the biggest band in Australia, but nobody knew who we were. And this is like a month after we came out of Superstar.
Wow.
And then we had this show that it was around New Year's Eve. So we did this show on New Year's Eve on the steps of the Opera House. Because you have to remember, in Australia, it's hot in that time of year, in the summer. And we played to 70,000 people. And so here we are, we're as green as grass. And we're playing to all these people, but people still hadn't digested us. They didn't know who we were, where we were from, what it was all about. They just loved these songs and this voice. And so that's how we began. And then consequently, Rod Stewart was touring Australia. And it was common practice for a local band to open for him. Well, since we were the biggest band at the moment, it was suggested that we open for Rod, which we did. And so we opened for him. And, you know, Rod Stewart at that moment was the biggest band, biggest act in the world. And so when I saw him for the first time, my jaw just fell. I'd never seen a real star before, you know, and it was like, wow, you know. And so we opened for him. We opened in Adelaide. And when we came off stage, we went back to the dressing room. We were so puffed up. We thought, oh, wow, what an amazing thing, because it was Rod's crowd. But they liked us. And when we came off stage, Rod Stewart was in our dressing room, and he said, I want you to open for me in the United States next year, and we're going to tour all over North America. And we didn't believe him at the time, But what he said was true, and we did. The next year, we played all the biggest venues in the world, Madison Square Garden for four nights, the Forum in Los Angeles, and the Spectrum in Philadelphia, wherever it is. And so once again, we had that incredible look, and it was just, it was just abounding for us at that time. But there was something really good going on, which we didn't realize at that time. And that was, even though we had all these great contacts and, you know, we opened for Rod, we became friends with his band. We learned, you know, because we didn't know what we were doing. We had Russell's voice and we had a lot of great songs, I think. But we didn't know anything about show business or anything. But in Superstar, we learned a lot. Almost 2 years, we learned whatever we could about musical theatre and people and orchestrations and bands and everything. And then when we opened for Rod, we learned all about rock and roll and how to handle an audience and what to do when you walk on stage and don't get stage fright, all those things. And there's a multitude of aspects about show business, you know. So when we finished that, we thought, oh, okay, now we're ready. But we came back to Australia and they'd forgotten all about us and we had to start again. But it gave us this tenacity because we'd been to the United States. And having seen it, we didn't want to stay in Australia anymore, you know, because we'd already been the biggest band there. And so we had nowhere to go except down. And so we were knocked off our perch pretty fast going back to Australia. You know, we couldn't get any shows. We felt really dejected and we felt betrayed by our audience in Australia. You know, nobody had done that. Nobody had opened for biggest act in the world before. Mm-hmm. Right. But we were really knocked down and put back in our place. And, you know, Russell had to get a job working on videos, holding fog machines. And I, you know, I just wanted to write some more songs. So I went away and I wrote like a dozen songs of a certain kind. And I called Russell up and I said, I think I've got some songs here that are really cool. And so he came to see me and I said, let me just play a few of these songs. And I just played them to him on guitar. The first song I played him was this simple song with four chords. And at the end, he said, that's the one. That's the one that's going to take us where we need to go. And the song was Lost in Love. And I didn't really feel it at the beginning. It was Russell that said, that's it, that's the one. And I said, okay, but I want you to listen to this one now. And I played him All Out of Love and The One with Love and Chances, all in a row. And he said, okay, we've got what we need. Now we've got to find a record company and make another album, which we did, you know. And that's how it all began again for us. That was our kind of rebirth, if you like. But with Superstar and touring with Rod and, you know, going overseas, it really gave us a world view. And had we stayed in Australia, I don't think we would have had that view. We would have been a lot less courageous and a lot less ambitious. But, you know, once you've been to the US, that's where we wanted to be because we felt it was right. And before we went to open for Rod in the US, our producer said, you know, if you stay here and we make another album, he said, it'll solidify your career in Australia. And he said, you could be the biggest band in Australia. And we said to him, we want to be the biggest band in the world, not just Australia. You know, and they didn't like that. Peter Dawkins, our producer, he didn't like that much because he felt he put a lot of energy into us, which he had. And that we betrayed him by leaving. But it was our career, not his, you know, and it was our choice to make. And it was a gamble, but, I mean, who wouldn't say yes to going to open for such a great artist as Rod. You know, it was ridiculous if you would turn it down. But we paid the price when we came back.
Yeah. Well, and regardless, Peter still got to say he was the first one to ask Peter the biggest fan in the world. So, and ultimately turned out to be a betrayal. He got to ride those coattails.
He did, yeah. I mean, I think saying that is one thing, because we were very ambitious, but saying it and then achieving it is two different things. But the thing is, one thing we had going for us, apart from the boys, and we had the songs, I think,
yeah.
One thing was we really didn't know what we were doing. So we couldn't make any mistakes, because it didn't exist for us. And we just kept doing it. And, you know, we made that second Australian album. It was a huge hit. Lost in Love was a hit in Australia. So was All Out of Love. But then nothing happened. And this was 1978. And we thought, gosh, you know, these songs are cool. The records sound fabulous. Where do we go now? There's nowhere to go but down. And by some other luck, I think the universe stepped in. Clive Davis heard Lost in Love. It must have been on his desk in New York. And he heard it, he loved it, and he called us up. And he said, I've got this copy of Lost in Love. He said, do you have an album? And we said, yeah, we do. And we said, we've made two albums. And he said, well, you need to make another album, all songs like this. And that's exactly what we did. But by the time we'd finished that album, Lost in Love, he'd released it, and it became the biggest song in the world. And it became Song of the Year and you know, all that stuff, and the Make a Music Awards and everything. So we'd achieved what we wanted to begin. And, you know, I remember after Lost in Love was a hit, we said, oh, wow, we've really made it now. We're, you know, the top of the world. But that was just the beginning. And, of course, once again, your hopes get bigger and bigger. Then we wanted another one. And we had, you know, 7 or 8 top fives in a row. And that was the beginning of a great career. And here we are 46 years later, you know.
Yeah. And for you guys, there's success as a musician, as a songwriter, as a performer. And then there's success where your fans have their own nickname.
Right, yeah, they're airheads, yeah.
And they have airheads. Can you talk a little bit about the fan base? Because I feel like that is a huge part of any performer's working career.
Yeah, it certainly is now. But from the very beginning of our career, we've always appreciated the fans. You know, we've always done meet and greets. I mean, meet and greets now, everybody does them. But we first started doing those maybe 30 years ago. And we've always done it. When, you know, our tour manager or managers would say, you know, at the stage door before we get in the car, we'd say, we want to talk to the fans and sign everything. And we sign everything until the last one's gone. And you say, no, don't worry, that's fine. Just get in the car and get out of it. And we say, no, we're going to stop. And we've always done it. And so consequently, the rewards from doing that now, we see as loyalty. Our fans are really super loyal. And, you know, as time goes on, you know, we all change. And it's funny, I see fans in the audience that I saw a long, long time, decades ago. And they're there, and they bring their children, their grandchildren. And I think it's because as we've made, and the music endears people to us. It's not to, you know, we've always thought that the music would bring people together, and it's a positive energy. It's a positive thing for everyone, and I think that's what they see when they see us and when they hear the music. You know, it's strange because, you know, I live in a remote area, and at my feed store, you know, I go and buy grain and birdseed and all that stuff, cat food. And quite often they have music playing, and I'll hear one of my songs, and I think, my, that song was released 40 years ago, and it's amazing, you know. And I think, wow. And I'm very surprised because it still sounds young and fresh and happening. And I'm very, very pleased about that. I go, yeah, that's really cool.
Music, tour dates, and so much more, check out Air Supply's website. They are at airsupplymusic.com.
You can check us out on all the various socials. Be sure to visit our website at rockandrollgradschool.com. And don't forget to leave us a review.
Today's show is produced by myself and Heidi Hedquist. Our reluctant producers are John Sauvé and Sandy Stone. Our willing producers are Rachel Allen and Randy Jeanette. Our intern is Zach Jackson. This one's for Philippe. Thank you. Good night. And may all your favorite bands stay together. It's